A strong agreement in Copenhagen to tackle climate change will keep humanity in control of its destiny. Lose that opportunity now, and we will shortly lose it forever. We are too close to an agreement now to fail at the last gate.
Welcome to the 300 to 350 show. Kicking off there with a suitably somber warning from the Executive Secretary of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, Ivo de Boer, about the dangers of not getting a global deal on climate change at Copenhagen in December. The possibility of that deadline slipping was raised recently after conflicting messages emerged from US legislators about whether the timetable for passing the so-called Waxman-Markey climate bill would be pushed back to next year. If the US does not pass this bill, also known as the American Clean Energy and Security Act, or ACES, does that mean that the US will not be able to bring anything to the table at Copenhagen? That was certainly the impression that Jonathan Pershing, lead negotiator for the US at the UN climate talks, sought to give at his press briefing in Bonn back in August.
Our whole focus is not to repeat Kyoto. In Kyoto, we first negotiated an international agreement, and then we brought it home and tried to ratify it. We couldn't do that. This time, we're trying it from the other end. We're approaching it from the domestic policy and looking to negotiate something that's consistent with our domestic policy so we can be in this deal. So for us, that's the linkage. How do we move something forward that's consistent with things that we can commit to so we will not be outside the agreement? And part of it is a function of our domestic systems, which are different from many others, in which there is this autonomy that Congress has. It's not the kind of parliamentary system that many governments run with. It has those distinctions. And we're seeking to use this process and work with this process. People understand what we want, and we negotiate with others so we hear what they want as we develop that. But when we come to the final deal, we'd like to be able to implement it and be a party to it.
However, President Obama and the US Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, already has existing authority to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act. Indeed, there has been the strong suggestion that if the Waxman-Markey bill did not pass, then President Barack Obama would use this existing authority instead. Here's Justin Rowlatt reporting for the BBC's Newsnight programme back in March.
But the administration has a problem. This cap and trade legislation is unlikely to be passed by both houses of Congress. So the question's been whether this would derail its plans. Yesterday, I interviewed a key Obama insider, John Podesta. He was the guy that oversaw President Obama's transition to power and is the chair of a think tank, which is very influential here in Washington. What John Podesta told me is that President Obama plans to circumvent Congress if it doesn't pass the climate bill. What he said was that he'd use the existing powers of the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, pretty much the equivalent of our Environment Agency, to impose this cap on carbon emissions. Here's what he told me.
Failure is not an option. The president has tremendous authority under existing law to really move this country forward under the Clean Air Act. In particular, you know, he can directly regulate carbon plant, power plant emissions. He can directly regulate tailpipe emissions from autos. And so I think that the Congress has to be aware that if they completely fail in their job, that there's somebody occupying the Oval Office who's going to get the job done for the American people.
That's pretty unequivocal, isn't it? But I also managed to speak to the head of the EPA herself. And while Lisa Jackson didn't directly confirm that her agency would step in, she did say that it's been flexing its regulatory muscles, and she said it would act as a backstop for the president.
There's a growing feeling in the US that the Waxman-Markey climate bill that successfully passed the House of Representatives in June and is now on its way through the Senate is the wrong bill. The feeling is that it has some good features, but it lacks overall ambition, and at its heart relies on the flawed cap-and-trade system. This market-based system would, for example, allow new dirty coal-fired power stations to continue to be built in the US up until 2020, at a time when leading climate scientist James Hansen has said that if we want to have any chance of retaining a habitable planet, we need to be closing down coal-fired power stations around the globe as fast as possible. Hansen, who is director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, has written in a personal capacity to President Obama, saying as much. Here he is being interviewed in Iowa, just before testifying against a proposed new coal plant in Marshalltown.
But what's become clear with global climate is that the only way we're going to keep climate within a reasonable range is if we phase out use of coal, except where we capture the CO2 and sequester it, because most of the carbon dioxide in the fossil fuels is in coal. So we could solve the problem. That would be 80% of the solution. But it does require that we have a moratorium on any new coal-fired power plants, and over the next 25 to 30 years, we're going to have to phase out those that exist.
Under the provisions of the Clean Air Act, the Environment Protection Agency could regulate against the building of new coal-fired power stations directly. To find out more about the battle within the US to put a strong package together that would enable Obama to start playing the long-overdue leadership role that befits the world's biggest historical emitter, I spoke to Daphne Wysham, who presents a weekly syndicated climate change show in the US called Earthbeat, and is founder and director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, a project of the Institute of Policy Studies Progressive Think Tank. The first question I asked Daphne was about the current status of the EPA's authority to regulate coal-fired power plants. Apologies for the rather crackly phone line to Washington, D.C. It clears up very quickly into our conversation.
The Environmental Protection Agency is reconsidering a memo that was put forward under Bush by former EPA Administrator Stephen Johnson that essentially dismissed the notion that the EPA was the appropriate institution to regulate CO2 emissions from coal-fired power plants and other sources. And so the new EPA Administrator, Lisa Jackson, in February of this year, she basically said she was going to reconsider this Bush-era memo and put the coal industry on notice that they were taking very seriously the recent Supreme Court decision, which had found that CO2 was in fact a pollutant that was endangering the health of people in this country. So just by virtue of her stating that she was going to reconsider this memo, that put on hold at least 17 coal-fired power plants that were in the pipeline. And those coal-fired power plants basically were put on hold because their future was uncertain. Now, had they gone forward, their greenhouse gas emissions would have been significant. It would have been roughly a 2% increase in all U.S. greenhouse gas emissions and about a 4% overall increase from the electricity sector. So clearly, the EPA has a role to play in reining in the significant coal-fired power plant emissions in this country. However, shortly after the Waxman-Markey bill was released, and that bill, which was produced by two U.S. House of Representatives members, Congressman Waxman and Congressman Markey, both Democrats, pledged to cut greenhouse gas emissions very little, basically about 2 to 4% below 1990 levels by 2020. But one of the conditions of this bill was that the lawmakers agreed to strip the EPA of its authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from all power plants, including coal burners, under the Clean Air Act. And their reasoning was that they were putting in place a cap-and-trade system between industries and that they didn't need regulatory oversight because that would conflict with this cap-and-trade system. So that's the first challenge, is that we now have a bill that has passed the House that strips the EPA of its authority to regulate CO2. Now we have in the Senate a rider that's being put on an EPA appropriations bill by a senator from Alaska, Senator Murkowski, and she is trying to do the exact same thing, only basically saying we need a year. She's trying to make it sound very benign, that we need a year to review what all of this means in light of the possibility that we may have some changes in the Senate in the form of a climate bill, some sort of cap and trade bill. And so they're going at it through a rider on the appropriations language for EPA.
Right. I mean, in contrast to the EPA authority using the Clean Air Act, you're saying that even the threat of using that legislation has held up 17
yes.
possible coal-fired power plants. How does the Waxman-Markey bill affect coal?
Well, there are many people who believe this is the best we can do. I'm not one of them. There are quite a few green groups that are saying, you know, this is huge progress from where we were under Bush, and we have, you know, Democratic-controlled House and Senate, and we need to get something as a marker bill in place. And the good thing about the Waxman and Markey bill is that they do have targets and timetables for renewables. They have good energy efficiency standards and so on. However, they're making huge trade-offs and redefining renewables to include everything from waste energy plants, i.e. incinerators, to biomass burners. They're calling that renewable energy. So as part of the target, you could see, you know, forests in the United States cut down and thrown into a biomass burner, and that would meet our renewable energy target, or, you know, incinerators meeting our renewable energy target. Then, in addition, they have 2 billion tons of carbon offsets per year, which is roughly equivalent to 30% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. And carbon offsets, as you may know, are highly dubious. The Government Accountability Office found that they were impossible to verify. So taking 2 billion tons per year and just setting that aside would mean that the U.S. would not have to cut its greenhouse gas emissions until 2030 under this bill. We could just buy our way out of the problem by offsetting our emissions in, you know, developing countries around the world, and carbon offsets domestically. We could, farmers could get carbon offset credits for no-till agriculture. You know, and no-till agriculture, is, it turns out, is standard practice in many states in the United States. So it essentially means business as usual. And quite a few of us have been making a lot of noise about this and saying this bill is actually worse than no bill, because it sets in place not only weak standards, but it strips us of what strong tools we do have, legal tools to go after coal burners under the EPA. And if anything, we need to strengthen these approaches rather than strip them from any future climate legislation.
Mm. I understand there's a kind of campaign against the removal of EPA authority in the Waxman-Markey bill. How big is that coalition that's forming around that, and how is that campaign going?
Yeah, well, we helped pull together, I work at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and direct a project called the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network there, and we helped pull together some hearings on Capitol Hill on the EPA authority issue, on the carbon offsets issue, and pulled in MoveOn.org and Friends of the Earth and Indigenous Environmental Network and Greenpeace and others to participate in that briefing. And there is now widespread opposition to this stripping of EPA authority under the Clean Air Act. Whether or not Boxer will release the bill, Barbara Boxer of California is chair of the Energy and Environment Committee, and she's set to release her version of the bill on Monday. Whether or not she will restore EPA authority remains to be seen. I know that there are people doing direct actions at her offices in California and demanding that this be restored. And an additional new development just occurred a couple of days ago, which is that a district court found that 8 states could sue coal-fired power plants under a public nuisance clause, meaning that you could see communities around coal-fired power plants suing to shut down these plants under this new decision. And so in a way, if the EPA authority is stripped, we do have another backstop measure here in the form of this legal opening that's just been put forward. So the coal industry is clearly getting pressure from a number of sides, and either it will come forward and accept, in some ways, it may be more willing now to accept the Waxman-Markey bill than it was before, because it certainly has gotten quite a few giveaways in that. If the bill remains as weak as it is in the Senate, you may see the coal industry coming to the table and signing off on it.
In terms of, you know, strengthening the U.S.'s overall level of ambition in order for it to play a kind of fair and adequate role at Copenhagen, you've already said that, you know, the ambition of the bill is going back to from today's emissions levels to 1990 levels. It's clearly not enough to save us from catastrophe and to seal a fair deal. What can be done to strengthen U.S. action?
Yeah, there is some room for optimism. All is not lost just because we have these horrible bills that are proceeding through the House and the Senate. First of all, U.S. greenhouse gas emissions have dropped by 9% just in the last 2 years. Now, some of that's due to the economic situation, but there is evidence that the wind power industry is playing a significant role in that drop. So greenhouse gas emissions have gone down quite a bit in the United States. I think we will see, as electric vehicles come online, as more fuel-efficient vehicles come online, I think we've really reached a watershed moment in the United States where there will be less and less demand for these gas-guzzling cars. After the price spike in oil last year, I think it really shook up the American public. We're not used to paying over $4 a gallon, unlike those of you in Europe. It really takes its toll, because we don't have very good public transportation in this country, and it is a very car-dependent country. So I think we will see a big shift in terms of fuel efficiency and the type of automobiles that people are buying in this country. There's also a sense that Obama may be able to cobble together a set of numbers that suggest that the U.S. is, in fact, headed towards roughly 20% reductions below 2005, not 1990 levels, by 2020. And that would be in the form of renewables targets and energy efficiency standards that are either in place or could very easily be put in place. There is some strong language in the Waxman-Markey bill that could either be stripped away and put in as a marker in another bill. Some people are suggesting that an energy bill that's already made it through both houses of Congress in the Bingaman energy bill could actually get us to the targets that we need to deliver, you know, meaningful targets in Copenhagen. There's also a cap and dividend bill that's about to be dropped by Senator Cantwell of Washington State, whereby she suggests it's similar to a carbon tax, but it would be revenue neutral, and the revenue would return to households every month. So there's a lot that's still in play, and there's certainly a lot of pressure building from grassroots groups all over this country. I think people are getting engaged in the issue in a way they haven't in the time that I've been working on climate issues, which has been almost 16, 17 years. So I think we're seeing a much more educated populace and a much more engaged citizenry, people willing to risk arrest at coal plants and that sort of thing.
Have you been following the General Assembly in New York? Were you impressed by either Obama's speech or the Chinese president's speech yesterday?
Well, I was more impressed by the Chinese speech than by Obama's speech. I think Hu Jintao put forward some very interesting proposals. I mean, again, there's a little bit of deja vu in terms of the energy intensity targets that we saw under Bush. But I think in this case, he is very serious. I mean, we're hearing studies about how China has seven times the amount of wind they would need for their entire economy, and I think they're beginning to recognize just how it is in their own interest, both from a, you know, an air pollution perspective, but also from a security perspective, that they move away from coal. And, you know, they are putting in place some pretty strong targets for wind production in China. So I think the Chinese are taking this seriously. I know that the Indians are also taking the issue seriously, with very strong investments in solar and solar thermal, and a sense that they may actually be willing to think about some sort of targets as well. unfortunately, Obama, I think, missed an opportunity where, you know, once again, he's very good at the lofty rhetoric, and he's very good at sort of speaking in abstractions, but he hasn't taken a leadership role either in this, you know, in the current legislative process at home, and I would say he missed an opportunity in New York as well to take a stronger leadership role.
Mm. Just going back to the offset debate and the cap and trade, I know the environment groups in the US seem to have been split on the issue, but there's still quite a high level of opposition to cap and trade. Is there any scope at this late stage for removing that piece of the Waxman-Markey bill?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the more people learn about offsets, as well as the more they learn about what could possibly unfold in a carbon market in the form of carbon derivatives and a whole new carbon bubble, and, you know, we've just gone through a housing crisis bubble, and I think people really are beginning to grasp what's at stake in terms of carbon markets overall. But the carbon offsets issue has been a little bit harder to get people to understand, partly because so many of the worst projects are so far away that it's hard to translate them for a domestic audience when you have, you know, steel mills in India or something that are just putting on energy efficiency equipment and that counts as carbon offset. It's hard to get people passionate about that. However, there has been, in California, there's been a strong environmental justice movement that has been taking on both carbon trading and carbon offsets, and they have severely restricted the amount of carbon offsets that could be used in California's climate and energy goals to, I think it's like 10 or 15%, only after all of the other approaches have been tried and failed, then they're allowed to you know, try to achieve their remaining greenhouse gas emissions through offsets. So I think we're seeing people really begin to try to, you know, use this as an option of last resort rather than first resort, and put far more transparency and accountability into place around these offsets.
Okay. One final question then perhaps is about the suggestion that we might not get a climate bill through the Senate by the end of the year. That would be a disaster, wouldn't it, for Copenhagen if that were allowed to happen?
No, I don't think so, actually. I think it would be a positive thing. I think we would get a stronger set of commitments if Obama steps in and pushes through a series of packages that are already, where there's little resistance around renewable energy standards and energy efficiency and CAFE standards and so on, rather than having a cap-and-trade bill in place that doesn't get us anywhere near where we need to go and that largely relies on carbon offsets to get there. And I think we're very close to legislation. However, and I'm optimistic given what we're hearing from a lot of other countries like France and Japan and Norway putting forward such strong targets, and India and China engaging in a real meaningful way. I think the U.S. will, if we walk away from Copenhagen with a sense of, you know, that we are willing to put forward some targets that are not based on legislation but are based on sort of restructuring how we write laws in this country and how we apply fuel efficiency standards and so on, I think in some ways that could be a much better scenario, and it would also mean that legislation wouldn't be that difficult to pass next year.
Okay. Has anybody been kind of formulating that in writing? Is this kind of plan B, if you like?
Yeah, in terms of putting that in writing, I mean, I know that there are quite a few people that are thinking along those lines, that this bill is worse than no bill. I mean, everybody from James Hansen, the top scientist with NASA, is saying that. There's a group called Climate SOS that's saying this bill is worse than no bill, the coalition of groups. Now, of course, there's an awful lot of pressure from groups like Environmental Defense Fund and Natural Resources Defense Council and others to put this in place now, because they fear in 2010 members of Congress will be caught up in elections again, and then it'll be hard to get their attention again, which is possible. However, I don't think we should despair and assume that all is lost if we do not get a cap-and-trade bill. I think we could do far better with strong energy efficiency standards, with strong regulatory authority, with legal pressure, and you know, in addition, of course, we do need to come to the table with money for developing countries, and there is pressure along those lines as well from a lot of groups to put money on the table, but not necessarily through a cap and trade bill.
That was Daphne Wysham, presenter of the weekly syndicated climate change show in the US called Earthbeat, and founder and director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, which is a project of the Institute of Policy Studies think tank. And if you want to keep up with US action on climate change, I strongly recommend you check out the Earthbeat Radio archive at www.earthbeatradio.org. The widely criticised cap and trade system, which we've looked at before on the 300 to 350 show, is of course the favoured option of the fossil fuel lobbyists and other corporate vested interests. But civil society has smelt a rat. Campaigners have been out on the street this week protesting against the corporate role in dictating government climate policy. As business leaders sat down to lunch in the UN building in New York this week, outside, protesters from the Climate SOS Coalition, the New York Climate Action Group, and Rising Tide North America gave out fake $2 trillion banknotes, whose design highlights the collusion between prominent green NGOs and corporate backers of the cap-and-trade bill. Climate SOS organiser Dr. Rachel Smolker said in a press release, "It is time that the interests of indigenous peoples, the poor, those living on melting ice and sinking islands, people coping with imminent hunger, and the public at large, be granted full participation in policy decisions, while corporate CEOs protest outside these events." On the West Coast, 500 people took part in an action against the Chevron oil company, including a mass die-in. Activists also stopped the traffic outside Senator Barbara Boxer's office in San Francisco by unfurling a parachute at an intersection which read, "Climate Justice or Climate Chaos." And thousands of people are gathering in Pittsburgh, including participants in the Three Rivers Climate Convergence or Climate Camp, as the G20 arrives in town. Also today, 125 civil society groups from around the globe have sent a letter to President Obama asking him to play a leadership role on climate change. Signees of the letter include Friends of the Earth International, Third World Network, 350.org, ActionAid International, the Global Forest Coalition, Jubilee South, the Indigenous Environmental Network, Christian Aid UK, FERN, Greenpeace USA, Eco Equity, International Rivers, Rainforest Action Network, the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, and many groups from Africa, Asia Pacific, Latin America, and the Caribbean. They write, "We urge your leadership in setting a vastly higher level of ambition for the United States' contribution to both emissions cuts and a package of finance and technology for developing countries. Without these commitments," they warn, "a successful outcome at the United Nations Climate Conference in Copenhagen in December is not possible." That's about all we've got time for on this week's 300 to 350 show. You can get references for this programme or hear the show again by visiting the Climate Radio Archive at www.climateradio.org, where the show will be posted in a few days' time. Thanks for listening.